previously on the What's in Your Head podcast.
If I go get soda, I usually go for a Coke.
Okay.
I'm for from some the reason, South. Everything is Coke.
That is so true. We'll get to that in a second. For some reason, I thought you were one of these Pepsi pussies. No, by the way, I don't know if you guys probably heard, Dr. Pepper has surpassed Pepsi.
Number two now.
Yeah, because Pepsi tastes like fucking stale Coke. Only Pepsi product I drink is Mountain Dew, which Mountain Dew needs to do what we want to do with California and break off. but yes, to Mike's point, I remember growing up in Kentucky, especially 1980. You come to my house, my cousin's house. Hey, Mike, you want a Coke? You say yes. You say, what kind? What do you have? Mountain Dew, Mellow Yellow, fucking orange. Yeah,
crust. It didn't.
Soda was Coke.
Yep.
You had Coke, and then you had all the subcategories, whether it's Mountain Dew, Dr. Pepper, Coke, Cherry Coke, Orange Crush. Everything was Coke.
Growing up in the Northwest, I had a completely different experience.
Was it soda?
Everything soda out pop. There was a pop.
Yep.
Yeah.
Kentucky, it was Coke. Ohio was pop. And then I know some people from the Northeast called it soda or soda pop. Download and listen to the What's in Your Head podcast at whatsinyourhead.com, d-410.com, Spotify, Apple Podcast, and wherever fine podcasts are found.
Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast. Joining us, as always, is, well, not Dennis. Dennis will be here. He's dealing with the Texas environment. Jeff is back from lands far, far away, and he's going to give us the whole rundown on his trip to Greece, but we're going to hold off on that for a little bit. In an effort to get Dennis here so he can help participate in that conversation. And so I wanted to show off a few things. So Jeff, when you were still overseas, Dennis and I were trying to, we were figuring out, what do we want to do for our D-Day podcast episode? You know, I've done in-depth storytelling on the operation, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, and there's a lot of World War II podcasts. We're going to have relatively the same content, you know, talking about all the going-ons and all the cool stuff. And unfortunately, we're not based over across the ocean like some podcasts are, who have the ability to do some frontline content. And so we said, hey, why don't we just do 20 minutes of get caught up on things, and then I will edit in interviews that I did with vets who were there. Let the D-Day story be told through the words of the vets who were at D-Day. And so we're like, great, cool. So we did that. And I went back and I edited some content from Papa Jake Larson, who was there on D-Day, and a pilot, a B-17 pilot, who participated up before and up to and after. His name was Keith Anderson. And in the interview, I don't even remember this because it was 2019 I did the interview. I asked him, I said, do you remember the name of your plane? He said, yeah, well, we only named one plane. After the one plane, we've had many other planes. We didn't have a name on it. But this one particular plane we named after, I think, is the gunner and his crew. His ex-girlfriend, who hurt his feelings, his name was Annie. And as a way to get back to Annie, I guess they referred to her as Anytime Annie, meaning she was ready to go at any time. So they named their plane Anytime Annie. And he was talking about how at the time the Air Corps was getting all this new modern technology. And so what was happening were a lot of the older planes were getting sent back for refit and getting some of the new radar systems, the new sonars, new radio equipment. And so I think they only had Anytime Annie for a short period of time. She got sent back for retrofitting and got some new equipment and then issued to another crew. And then sadly that crew got shot down, and that was the end for Anytime Annie. Well, as I'm editing this and getting it ready to put into the final format, I said, well, I do what I do a lot of times. I get on Google, type in Anytime Annie, and I see two posts. One of it was this very cool website out of Germany that actually has the name of some bombers that they found records for and the manufacturing dates and what plant they came out of, but there wasn't any real photos. It had like some generic photos of some B-17s. And then I see this eBay auction. It's a photo of a gentleman like on a scaffolding. He's got his hand on his chin and he's looking at this pinup art, fully topless, and it says above it, Anytime Annie. And this photo was for sale, so I bought it. And here's the photo. And I thought, well, how cool is that to have the photo, one of the only few photos I ever found of this plane, that the gentleman we interviewed on our podcast was part of the ceremony of naming it. Now, this isn't the end-all, be-all photo. Clearly, this guy has negatives, and he's just printing new ones. And I got to think about it. I was like, well, Keith Anderson was recommended to me by someone in the local Florida World War II reenacting community. It was his girlfriend's grandfather. And sadly, he passed away, I don't know, 5 or 6 months after the interview. So I've since gone on eBay and bought a second one, and I want to give it to them so that they could have a picture of the plane, not only that their grandfather flew on, but that his cohort's named after the ex-girlfriend of their gunner. So I just thought that was kind of cool to have here in the podcast. Kind of a small world type thing, you know? And the fact that not only did I find a picture on Google, but I found one that's a high-quality reprint off of the original negative. So I was excited about that. And then the other thing I want to get caught up on real quick, just because of D-Day, if you guys remember, I think back in February, March, I found that virtual race. It was the to commemorate the 80th anniversary of D-Day. You downloaded the app, you went out and you had to run 80 miles. Obviously not all at one jaunt. You could choose how quickly or how slowly you ran. The cutoff time was going to be June 6th. I think I got it done in like a month and a half. And the cool thing is you would run, you would track it with a running app, and then you would upload your progress, proving that you made the run. And the cool thing is when you uploaded your miles, it showed you the D-Day invasion map, and it kind of puts you as if you landed. And so if you did 15 miles or 5 miles that day, it showed you on that route, but then it had little checkpoints, like Pointe du Hoc or St. Mary Dumont, some of the gun placements, and give you a little history. And it was kind of cool, especially if you weren't into this history as much as we are. You could potentially learn some pretty cool stuff. And then you upload your stuff, and then I think June 1st rolled around and they started mailing out medals. Now, I have a lot of running medals, but this is the only one I've ever had. It's got the Normandy beaches. It says D-Day, 80 miles on it. Has a Mustang on there. So with all my running medals from my physical running races, I can now have a World War II themed one that helps commemorate and kind of educates people through fitness, which some could argue we probably could use a lot more of that these days. But other than that, things have been getting a lot of rain down here, but I'm excited to hear about your trip.
Yeah, well, first, I mean, I think that's pretty cool that you found that photograph of Anytime Annie. I mean, I think a lot of people, you know, when they talk to B-17 crew, I'm like, oh, what was the name of your plane? And I think it's surprising for a lot of people to know that they weren't always in that same airplane, right? I mean, when you dig through and you look at the actual real story of the Memphis Belle, it just kind of gets muddled in who was flying what and, you know, who gets credit for what mission and all that, you know, and... So I think it's great with all of the new craze about the 8th Air Force, especially with what we've got in cinema now, for people to kind of do a little bit more research on that. So I think that's really great you found that. And on your virtual run, I think that's another really cool thing too, because, you know, World War II, boy, it's 80 years ago now, and we've got to find new and fun ways to keep it going. You can only read so many books. There's only so many movies. We got the video games. Okay, like let's figure out a way to still educate people that may not be their niche, right? But it figured out a way to kind of, you know, open that pathway to history in a creative way. So I think it's really great that you got to do that.
And they did it in a sensitive way. It wasn't like all glamorized or, you know, anything you could deem somewhat offensive or opposite of what the intent, you know, the fact that D-Day was coming up. So it was pretty cool. Right. And I think you mentioned in past podcasts that if you watch the Hollywood mainstream version of Memphis Belle from like 1985, 88, 89, or 91, whatever year it was.
90, yeah.
That the characters depicted in that movie weren't based on any of the characters that, well, characters... end quote, any of the servicemen actually served on there. And as a young man, you're talking to the pilot, and I guess he kind of expressed to you that the goal of that movie was to tell the story of all Air Corpsmen and not us as individuals. We didn't want to be glamorized. Yeah, they used the name of our plane and our mission hardships, but we weren't overly concerned with them portraying us as we were, or even use their names for that matter.
Yeah. Yeah, which I think was really neat. I mean, yeah, that's a that's a whole nother, we could do a whole episode just on that. But yeah, I thought that was really neat that they didn't center it on the individual specifically, but more of a culmination. But there's time for that, you know, to go into like with Masters of the Air, right? They're more on the individual and, you know, trying to show from their point of view and what those guys were really like. And I think that's amazing, too. So either way, you know, you get the information out there, you make people want to learn a little bit more, and it's a success either way.
Well, while we're waiting on Dennis, so you can explain your trip and give us the rundown on that, I have a story here that I wanted to wait until you were back on the show because, well, you've worked at museums and you have a passion for this particular topic, so I want to get your take on it. Not so much an opinion, but just your take on it. Michigan Flight Museum sells popular World War II era Yankee Lady aircraft. Belleville, Michigan. The Michigan Flight Museum has sold its World War II era Boeing B-17 Flying Fortress, known as the Yankee Lady, one of the last remaining airworthy versions of the aircraft in its existence. The former Yankee Air Museum Board of Directors unanimously decided to sell the bomber in May because reliance on the aircraft meant any prolonged term grounding of it would cause financial hardships, according to the statement. Quote, the Yankee Lady has become a significant generation of revenue for the museum, to the extent that we have developed an unrealistic dependency on it, the statement reads. Simply put, interruption in its revenue stream due to the aircraft's inability to participate in our flight program has become hardships for the museum. In other words, we don't feel the museum can ensure her flying future. Sorry about that, an advertisement just moved my paragraph. We do not feel the museum can ensure her flying future to the extent we feel is appropriate for a historical artifact of her importance and rarity. Though more than 12,000 B-17s were produced between 1935 and 1945, there are only about 45 today in the complete form. Yankee Lady is one of only six that are airworthy as of November 2023. The museum restored the aircraft to flying condition after acquiring it in 1986, according to the museum's website, and has ordered rides in the aircraft to pay museum's visitors since early... I'm sorry, has offered rides in the aircraft to paying museum visitors since the early 2000s. Michigan Flight Museum President and CEO Kevin Walsh said, the museum has offered rides in some of its planes, including the Yankee Lady, for a fee. The cost of the ride of the museum's other planes ranges between $115 to $525 per ride. Walsh said that though the museum currently is in good financial position, selling the plane made sense to the museum's future. We are in an excellent financial position, Walsh said in the interview. The museum is very strong, but only because we constantly have these very difficult decisions to make. And they didn't really go into why they were going to have to ground it. I don't know, maybe they made this decision after the Dallas wreck a few years ago, but clearly there was talks of grounding their program for a while, right? At least that's what the story made it sound like.
Yeah, I know nothing about this. This is the first time hearing about it. So my initial reaction is I'm surprised it was unanimous. I mean, that's a pretty strong, okay, we need to get rid of this thing, all in favor. And my next question is, who bought it?
Walsh said he could not name the buyer of the aircraft or the price it sold for due to a non-disclosure agreement, but did say it is not going to a private collection on the West Coast. I'm sorry, I can't read tonight. But said it is going to a private collection on the West Coast. The buyer intends to display it and fly the aircraft, which will be transported to the new owner in the next few weeks, Walsh said. In a small way, It is exciting next chapter for the airplane and its longevity, and then also for its public display. Walsh said, you've got somebody who has a high desire to display the airplane and to fly it. Everything he has flies, and that is his goal. So with a name like that, I'm sure they're not going to rebrand it. I'm sure we'll find out what it, who it is and where it's going probably by the end of next year.
Yeah. Well, I mean, hey, it sounds like, you know, the museum, you know, yeah, that was a tough decision to make, I'm sure. But it sounds like that was something that they were discussing for quite some time, and the possibility of that thing being grounded, or you just have some kind of, you know, an issue where, you know, that's expensive to keep that thing running. So if they need an engine somewhere or something that's keeping it from being airworthy, yeah, I do know that in the museum field that you typically just don't have money laying around, you know.
So, and let's keep in mind, this isn't a Cessna or a modern-day jetliner. I'm sure the pool of certified pilots who are willing, have the time, or available to fly that is probably a small pool too, especially in Michigan.
So yeah, to have somebody that's multi-engine tailwheel certified is... Yeah, I'm sure that's few and far between. So, I mean, like I said, probably a tough decision, but good on them. I'm glad they found it. Looks like there's somebody who has the means to keep it going. Interesting to learn that that's one of six that's airworthy. That's a surprisingly low number. I feel like there's more in the world. Maybe there's only six here in the States. I feel like there's more, but maybe not. Maybe not.
I guess how many planes were flying over D-Day? I mean, you know.
Yeah. That's the thing. I feel like there's a couple, I thought, B-17s based out of England. Not sure. Either way, it's a low number. I mean, yeah, I think we built something like just over 12,000 during World War II. And more than half of that were lost to enemy action. So, and I don't know if you've seen the pictures, but there's a B-17 graveyard in Arizona, you know, color picture from 1946 or something. And I mean, they are just, they're everywhere. And mostly became beer cans and scrap metal, you know.
I understand military rivalry. This is from taskandpurpose.com. Soldiers in the 82nd Airborne and 101st Airborne Divisions fought together on D-Day 80 years ago. But they carry on a fierce rivalry over hallowed spots and two liberated... I'm sorry, liberal... Hallowed spots the two liberated across Normandy. The latest chapter in the feud came this week as... Oh, task and purpose sign in pop up. Sorry about that. Feud came this week when the 82nd paratrooper took down the 101st flag flying over the stop bar in St. Mary Glees. So you had a group of modern day 82nd Airborne members take down the 101st Airborne flag that was flying over a bar in St. Mary Glees. The video emerged this week as the 82nd paratroopers climbing atop the stop bar in the town center square and cutting down the 101st Airborne flag as a dozen of current and former paratroopers cheered from the streets below. The stop bar in St. Mary Glees Central Square has long been a center meeting spot for the 82nd troops and vets. And the 82nd paratroopers who were there told Task and Purpose what happened. Quote, the past few anniversaries we've had in our drunken splendor mentioned that we want to take that filthy thing down because the 101st has never landed in St. Mary Glees, and it was in the 82nd Airborne, the town was first St. Mary Glees, and that this is the 82nd town first and foremost, the paratrooper said. So the 101st has no place in St. Mary Glees, so to have their flag above this bar has to stop. So they cut the flag down.
I mean, I think that's great. That's part of the whole military experience, right? I mean,
yeah.
There's always inter-service rivalry from unit to unit, sometimes from platoon to platoon, I remember even in my own unit, we were two platoons and then the seven of us that were PSD, and oh my gosh, just the back and forth between how many missions first platoon did as opposed to second platoon. You know, it gets down to the nitty-gritty there, but then when push comes to shove, you know, then we all kind of join hands and the enemy as if none of that happened. So I think it's just the nature of the military that they got to be fighting something.
Yeah.
If they're not fighting something, they'll fight each other. And that's part of it, right? I mean, that kind of reminds me of the opening scene of Patton. You know, Americans, you know, love a winner. You know, we're always, we like, you know, we want our favorite sports team to win, or our favorite boxer, or the fastest dog or horse or whatever we want to bet on. That's just kind of our nature. So it's interesting that that's still around 80 years after they jumped in, for sure.
You don't have to be a ball player to strike out. You have B.O. at home.
Here right, one.
B.O. at work.
Here right, two.
B.O. with friends.
Here right, three. You're out.
Well, folks, it's true. If you're careless about B.O., it's three strikes and you're out. So play safe. Take a tip from the Big League Baseball stars. Stop B.O. with a daily Lifebuoy bath or shower. And say the new 1942 Lifebuoy is new. It's different. It makes a hit every time. New added ingredient. New vanishing scent. Same protective lather. Get several cakes of the new 1942 Lifebuoy today. Remember, if you're careless about B.O., it's three strikes and...
you're out!
Yes, there's nothing more dismal than...
WLVN, 1940s radio. The place to go if you want authentic, real-time 1940s music, sports events, news, and much more. If you have a World War II event coming up, and as much of us do at our living history events, sometimes we get a nice old-fashioned radio. We'll put a Bluetooth speaker in it, and we'll stream some appropriate music. Problem is every once in a while when you're streaming that music, a Pandora ad might kick in, or a YouTube ad, or whatever host commercial from where you're playing this music, unless you've taken the time to record your own music and save it as a file. We can do you one better. Head over to WLVN 1940s Radio, or check, or simply click the link on our website. Go and stream their music live. Thanks to the station manager over at WLVM, Mr. Anthony Leota, who has painstakingly taken his time to get authentic sports events, radio broadcasts, news broadcasts from the time, and he builds a radio station in real time, just like a modern-day radio station. Modern-day radio stations has an entire schedule built from 12 a.m. until 12 a.m. the following day of all the music, commercial spots, and stories that are going to be ran throughout the day. Anthony has done the same thing, except for his music comes from the 1940s and 1930s. His news reports are actual news reports that were archived from the 1940s. His sporting events are actually archived from the 1940s. So if you want a very authentic, very original concept way to listen to music and content from the 1940s, head over to WLBN1940sradio.com. So give us the rundown. You, through a program through your school district, you were selected to chaperone or be a chaperone amongst other chaperones and a group of cats that were going to travel to the other side of the globe. And the cool thing about this particular program is I guess they let you all select and have a conversation of where you want to go instead of having a place preordained by the organization. And as you were explaining a few weeks back, you guys came on the idea of a particular place.
Yeah, so it is kind of a neat program how it works, because as the teacher or chaperone or group leader, you pick the location. This organization has an office here in Texas and then an office in Spain. So the trip's already designed, right? So you look at, okay, you want to go to here for 10 days and it shows you the itinerary or here or whatever. So you kind of shop the catalog. And then as it gets closer, you kind of tell them the dates that you would like to travel. And then as you get closer, they pair you with any other schools that might be wanting to do that same trip. And they kind of put you together. So I ended up with there were six students with me from here from Texas. And then there was a group of about 25 from a town in Colorado. And then about nine from Ogden, Utah, that chose the tour called Epic Greece. And I, as my first time doing this, I wanted to kind of start from the beginning. And that it was a pretty easy choice for me to pick Greece. I had several students that showed interest in it as well, so I thought, okay, and they were, you know, seniors, so recently graduated students. My son was one of them. Sorry, guys, he wants to go to Greece. You know, let's get this thing going. So it took about a year, a little longer, in planning. And yeah, it was not only the trip of a lifetime. It's just so hard to describe, and pictures don't do anything justice. But for the sake of, you know, what's the scuttlebutt and some of the content there was a lot of World War II things that I got to see. You know, some of the places were very heavy, you know, history in World War II, and the overall tour leader, she knew that. She knew my background. We kind of get to know each other a little bit before we meet. So I sent her some of our content and some of the things that we do in living history. And, you know, she said, wow, this is really neat stuff, you know, because in a country like Greece, some of these things are not really thought of, right? Greece is, it's a very unique country. I will say that. I mean, they're really good at still fighting each other until there's a bigger enemy, and then they'll band together again. But for thousands of years, there's always kind of been this kind of unrest. I mean, we think we've got political unrest in the United States, nothing like that over there. They want to be America so bad. And you can see it in a lot of the touristy places. You can just see that they want to have the things that we could only complain about.
And to that point, they often say, you know, you don't understand what you have until it's gone. And it has to be sad for you, but hopefully a learning experience for the kids who went. The irony that so many people who don't live in our country want to either be in our country or create their own micro version in their country. But when you're here in our country and you watch the news, there appears to be a small group of people that are blown up to be a bigger fraction of what they are by the media, who seem like they want to be anywhere but here or turn this country into somewhere else. And it's just like, that probably never became more apparent than you, as you said, being over in a different country and seeing they're trying to recreate what we have here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I saw a little bit of that in the military too, you know, and that's kind of where my first lesson came in, was like, wow, in some ways we're, you know, we've got other militaries out there that are just like laughing at us, you know, with our lavish, you know, food and rations and all the up armored vehicles and all the money that we've got, you know. And some countries don't have that available, so they depend more on just the overall, you know, harder training and just overall harder men in uniform, you know, to be able to perform over there. I mean, we really do have it so well, and it, you don't realize it until you compare it next to something else, right? So I've always told my students that, you know, I think the best advice I can give anybody on learning is to go be culture shocked three times in your life. And you don't necessarily have to leave the United States to experience that, but to truly be culture shocked, to see how other people live, to, you know, it kind of promotes empathy and understanding and just humanity. And I think it's important. So Greece was no exception to that. The students definitely they were definitely culture shocked. They got to learn the language. We got to eat the food, see some of how the culture interacts differently than we do. Some of the things were very odd, you know, or just like, wow, this is weird. Why would they do this? You know, well, because this is the best thing they've got, right? You have to remember, you have to put these things into perspective. But like I said, Greece is really very, very, like, overshadowed in the Second World War, and it shouldn't be. Like I said, the longer I spent there, the more places we went, the more I saw, you know. So like, for example, day two, we're at the Acropolis, we're at the Parthenon, you're overlooking Athens, and there are several pictures of, you know, the Germans who put up, you know, the Nazi flag right there at the Acropolis. If you go back and look at those pictures, And some of them, I think, have been colorized. You'll see the Acropolis looks a whole lot better than it does now. And that thing's been pummeled for the last 2,400 years, but no exception in World War II. The Parthenon was kind of a crossfire between the Germans and the British and Greek forces, so it sustained some damage during the Second World War. There's a great story of a Greek teen, I think he was only about 18 or 19 years old, that one night snuck up to the Acropolis, to the Parthenon there, and took the Nazi flag down in the middle of the night, you know?
That's a ballsy move. That's not just, you know, stealing the community college's mascot. That's yeah. potential death sentence.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So definitely challenge the listeners to look into that ordeal. It's pretty interesting. And then as you travel further north through Greece, as we went to Thermopylae, of course, you know, if you've seen the movie 300, everybody's familiar with the Battle of Thermopylae, I would hope. Probably don't understand the importance of it when it comes to the United States and our democratic form of government, right? That was really, truly what preserved Demos Kratos, or what we have called today as democracy, right? So that was their way to govern the Greek city-states. And some of that is what we have, you know, molded the Constitution from. So kind of an important date in history, right? This is 480 BC when that battle takes place. But fast forward to 1941, and about 80% of Greece is mountainous. 80% of that country. Very, very rugged terrain. So when the Germans attacked in 1941, you can imagine there's only so many places that this panzer column and armored vehicles can get through. One of them happens to be the pass at Thermopylae. So it was interesting for me to learn that there was not only the Battle of Thermopylae in 480 BC, Leonidas and all that, but there was a battle, a second battle of Thermopylae in 1941, when Greeks blew this bridge right next to the mountain pass where Leonidas was flanked from behind, the little mountain pass, you know. And so the Greeks blew a bridge to kind of, you know, stall the panzer column. So that was interesting to see, to be right there, where two very significant battles happened in history.
Now, when you see this area where these battles happened, and we've asked this question to people who've seen battlefields before, did the area, was it a lot larger than you anticipated? Was it smaller? Did it seem just about right? Because, you know, we've seen the movie, you've read the history, you've probably seen maps and diagrams of the movements of the battle from the, you know, the 300 story, and then with your recent research of the panzer fight. When you're standing there, does it exceed your anticipation? Or it was like, wow, this is a lot smaller than I thought it would be. Just the layout of the bottleneck, if you will.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's a great question. And the answer to that is we were not on the site where the battle took place in ancient history. That is, so there is a large mountain range that runs through there. On the east side of the range, close to the Aegean, is where the Persians came through. On the west side of this mountain range is where the panzer column came through, and that's where the main thoroughfare, that's the main highway that runs kind of north and south there. So we were on the opposite side of the mountain range from where the Spartans and Athenians and all, you know, all that took place when they were holding back the Persians. Now, I can say this, even though I wasn't there on that particular soil, it would look very different than it did back then, because the waters of the Aegean have receded tremendously. And it's obvious in a lot of other places we went to in Greece where you can see a lot of that. This was underwater, and I'm talking very significant. So that part really, I mean, yeah, there's not the Aegean and then a 50-foot, you know, pass and then a rock cliff. But there was. I mean, it's obvious to see from the people that I know who have actually been there. If you can imagine the water much higher, it's easy to portray or to visualize what's been portrayed in movies and such. But in 1941, it's a lot like how we see it today. So there was no sense in having to follow the Aegean. It's not like they were the Persians having to be supplied, you know, from the water there. So the Germans just kind of took path least resistance, kind of where this main highway, you know, runs through the country. So did get to see that and did get to see the hot springs, which gave Thermopylae its name. Got to see that water, which was really cool. Just it was very, very hot. I mean, there's no kidding. That is a hot spring. You get kicked in the face by the smell of the sulfur. Mm-hmm. It is so strong. But to see that water is still running today was just like you're looking back in time.
Yeah, it's one of the things that you just cannot get the sense of when watching TV or movie or reading books is the smell. But yeah, hey, you're just drinking out of a mug there. Now, we've seen the photos on Instagram, but I don't think you've been on the episode since you won that. Do you have two of them now? I see one over your shoulder, and you just drank from one of them.
The Toby mug. Yeah, I was going to kind of save that for the end of the episode here.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, we can cut to it. I just saw you drinking from it. So, but yeah, we'll tease it.
Yeah. Let's hang on to that.
Now you stopped at a museum, and I guess you pulled the hey. You know, me and Dennis were kind of joking about it. You know, whenever Dennis is around other authors, he has a common bond. He's done research and he speaks the language. You, being a veteran of working in museums, you show up at the museum and spoke the language, and they gave you kind of a tour, and you got to take some photos and make some content, which we're going to use as Patreon exclusive content coming up. And so that'll be up here. Y'all got to give some time to edit the stuff together, but there will be some content that Jeff shot that I haven't seen, Dennis hasn't seen. So that'll be coming up soon. So if you haven't done so, head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com or go to Patreon and search for Digital 410 Media or click on the Patreon link on our website. Sign up, subscribe. It's $1 a month. You'll get access to that exclusive content. We just posted a exclusive content full-length video of the interview we did with Dan King. I posted, I think, a shortened, like extremely shortened version, like a 15-minute version for general public on YouTube, but we're going to start doing more of that. We're going to take the full-length video interviews and make it exclusive Patreon content, as well as cool little side projects like what Jeff did as well. So head over to patreon.com, sign up and subscribe. It'll be $1 a month, and it goes a long way. And we're looking forward to that. Anything else exciting come or surprising come on your trip over there?
Yeah. So the last part of the trip at the northern region, basically what was old Macedonia, the northern region of Greece, our last stop, we were there for a few days, was the town of Thessaloniki, which was kind of a bucket list for me. There were several bucket list items, of course, throughout this trip, right? But to see the statue of Alexander the Great sitting right there on the Aegean, twice was on a boat sailing the Aegean. One was a glass bottom. That was amazing. But Thessaloniki, it's the second largest city in Greece and had a thriving Jewish community in 1941. And I think I shared with you a picture of there was a panzer column running down the Aegean there. And then I took a photo almost from the exact same place. You can see what's called the White Tower behind it, which was built in the 15th century. We got to tour that tower. But so you can see, you know, the change from 1941 to 2024, right? There's a panzer in the one photo, and then there's like a guy on a Segway or something in the next photo. There's a beautiful monument that overlooks the water right there. I think it was dedicated in the 90s. I want to say 1997, dedicated to the 50,000 Jews who all ended up in the gas chambers at Auschwitz-Birkenau. The entire Jewish population at Thessaloniki was wiped out. So when you're standing exactly where panzers were rolling through, and you can see just a monument like that to know the devastation that was caused by the German occupation of Greece in World War II, it does give you another perspective, because here in America, we can study it all we want, but until you go to some of these places to know that there is a large hole because of this occupation, right?
Yeah.
it's another level. It's a whole nother level. So the last day I was there, I ended up getting some free time. I had one student that could tag along with me, and I took her to the Thessaloniki War Museum, which was more modern. When I say that, remember, we were at the Parthenon. So for them, a modern museum takes place in the Greek Revolution of 1821 and then through the present. Lots of World War II artifacts. Saw an autographed copy of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf.
Wow.
You know, autographed by him. Lots of Nazi dinnerware and silverware, money. The weapon systems, the amount of weapon systems in that museum was unbelievable. The mannequins, sometimes you can get turned off by mannequins in a museum, right? But well done mannequin displays. Just rich in the amount of artifacts, right? Not just newspapers and signs everywhere, right? Just sometimes it was just large glass display cases with 20 or 30 items in there, donated from private collections that kind of takes you through the process of the Germans coming in and blitzkrieging through Greece, which, by the way, the Germans lost more soldiers in one day coming into Greece than they did in 11 other countries that they invaded during the Blitzkrieg. So staggering. Even though, yes, the Germans did eventually occupy, it was at no small cost for the German military. In fact, there was one place, one fort that it will remind you of the general's response in Bastogne with the simple nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there is a day known as Ochi Day. Ochi means no in Greek, O-X-I. And it's because that was the Greek garrison's commander's response to the Germans when they asked them to surrender. It was one simple word. No. Nope. And I believe that was never actually fully taken by the Germans. I believe they just were like, you know what, screw this. We're going to go around it. It's too costly.
Yeah.
So lots of interesting stuff there. So for our Patreon subscribers, I took a lot of photographs of some of these one-of-a-kind artifacts you can only see in the Thessaloniki War Museum, and some really neat photographs of very recognizable military vehicles and aircraft outside of the museum because they were all originally American vehicles and aircraft that, you know, how we are. We take our leftovers, we send to our allies, so you see Greek M8, armored cars and 113 armored personnel carriers and
probably some old M1A1 tanks.
Yeah, none of those yet. But I think I saw a World War II era Mark 13 torpedo sitting out there and a 75mm pack howitzer, just camouflaged with a Greek marking. But it was very clearly, all from the American arsenal at one time. So that was interesting to see as well. So happy I got to go over there. Happy I got to share it with some of our listeners, so hopefully they tune in and check out some of that stuff. And if they have any questions, they know to email us as well.
That's mailcall@WTSPWorldWar2.com. That is mailcall@WTSPWorldWar2.com. Programming update. We have a great guest coming on next week. Jeff, if you want to plug that for the audience.
Absolutely. So, yeah, to back up to the Toby mug you mentioned, the night before I left for Greece, I put in on a little giveaway on Instagram, and I could not believe I won. But I did, and it was amazing. Thank you, Archbury LLC. If you don't follow Archbury LLC, you have to right now. If you have any interest in the 8th Air Force, 12 o'clock high, Masters of the Air, they've got some amazing content. And the rules for the giveaway were very simple. You had to follow them. You had to follow Warbird Coffee. You had to follow author John Slemp. And tag somebody you thought would appreciate this giveaway. And I couldn't believe it. I got tagged in their winner video. So that was where I got the large Toby mug. And then the smaller Toby mug for drinking out of, and that's going to travel with me. a couple bags of Warbird Coffee Company's 51 coffee and P47 coffee, a couple Warbird Coffee mugs, some really nice 8x10 glossy photos from the 12 o'clock high movie, like this one right here,
nice,
of Gregory Peck. There's a couple of Gregory Peck and Dean Jagger.
That's a hell of a giveaway. Well, that's not just one, you know, one mug and a pack of coffee. That's a good giveaway.
It's an unbelievable giveaway. And to top it all off, and talking about next week's episode, we are going to have the author of Bomber Boys. This is an amazing coffee table book, 400 pages. It is beautiful. And this came in the giveaway as well.
He really?
Autographed it, signed it for me, left me a good note. So I contacted him, and I think I spent about an hour talking on the phone and hearing his story. He's an award-winning photographer. The book was, I think he said, 8 years in the making, and it all started with photographing bomber jackets.
Wow.
And then the rest is history, and we're going to let him tell that story next week. But it's a beautiful book, Bomber Boys by John Slemp, and we will have author John Slemp on the show next episode. I am so excited about that. I think our listeners are really, really in for a treat with John.
And I just got my Masters of the Air Blu-ray in from China, so I'm going to kick that off this weekend. Hopefully it plays, and then maybe the following week we can finally do some coverage of Masters of the Air. It seems to be legit.
Yeah.
It's got hologram stickers, and it's in a official looking Blu-ray pack. It doesn't look like it was filmed off somebody's DVR, so I think it's on the up and up, so we'll find out. But hopefully we can get together and cover Masters of the Air. But thank you guys so much for your continued support over the last 5-6 years now. I've lost count. We've changed and grown, and things are getting better and better. And thanks to all the Patreon members who subscribe and help us. And if you haven't done so, please head over to youtube.com, look for D410 Media. You can watch our podcasts, our other World War II content, which I think this week I'm going to force myself, as much as I hate to do it. Somebody requested, they wanted to know how to attach the poncho to the 782 web system, including the haversack from the Marine Corps. I did a part one where I showed how to attach the lower, and I was going to kind of half-ass and just do the blanket and the shelter half. I said, nay, our audience deserves more. As much as I hate to do it, I'm going to adjust the straps on my original one, because I don't wear it. I wear my repo when I do events, so it ain't going to matter, and get the suspenders and do the whole rigmarole. That's a great pack system when you're not trying to put the suspenders into play. I've done it once before. I don't like doing it because you do have to completely take the tabs off of your haversack and put them in different places. But I am going to do a complete video on the correct way to roll out your World War II Marine Corps kit, including suspenders and shelter half. So I'm going to get that up to accompany the first video I did, where I showed how to pack the pack, what goes in the pack, and the difference between some of the earlier models and later models. And so that'll be up on the What's the Scuttlebutt playlist on our YouTube channel probably within the next few weeks. Did I show you the machete I got?
No.
Oh, yeah. Hold tight. So a friend of mine named Zach, I think he's going to return. I think he's close to 70 now. It's hard to keep track of him for years. He used to be a customer of mine. He served in the Army in the mid-80s. He actually gave me his 1980s era rack, his cot. That's what he used in my World War II weekends. And then he went into Navy EOD, was a Navy EOD for a few years, and then retired, and then worked on weapons systems for the United States government. And on his lanai, he's got like 3-inch pieces of steel with big old holes blasted through them. And so he gave me that cot, and I noticed a few years ago he had 2 Marine Corps machetes in his garage, original. And he still uses them to whack away at plants, because he has award-winning vegetation in his yard up until the hurricane came and knocked it all down. But he actually won awards through Cape Coral for having indigenous landscaping. And I was there that one day, I was like, he's going to have yard sales, like, you're not going to sell one of those machetes, are you? He's like, I don't know if I still have them. And I said, no, you have them. They're in your garage on the third shelf up on the right. So he went out there and he pulled them out. He had two of them. It's in bad shape, but I can get it cleaned up. And he refused payment. And so this is an original U.S. Navy MK2 Legitimus Cutting Company, 1945. But it also has the marked U.S. Navy MK2 original scabbard with it as well. And for a Marine Corps impression, I guess these are pretty hard to come by, the original ones. I think I'm going to take it to a knife guy and have him try to clean this bad boy up. It's got some pitting on it, but to have an original one's pretty damn cool.
Yeah. Very cool.
But, yep. So I think that's going to wrap it up for this episode. Dennis did send us a text. He didn't ghost us. He's doing cowboy stuff on the ranch. Can't blame him. But, we want to thank everybody for supporting the show. And we will talk to you all soon. So, for myself, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker, thank you guys so much. And we'll talk to you next week.
This has been a Digital 410 production.